for your patience, and I beg your pardon for this tardy start. This afternoon, we are going to go ahead into a work session on the Oregon State Library. That's Senate Bill 5524, and Katie Cowan is our representative from the Legislative Fiscal Office. Jamie Penn is here this afternoon, but first, we appreciate Jamie here. Bless her heart, she's got a headache, but she's going to go ahead and tolerate us anyway. So, if we can go here, are we the cause of the headache? By and large, Representative Krupp, I think that you could safely say that we are substantially the cause of most of the headaches in this building. Men, women, children, and we find out also dogs are not safe while we're in session. let's see, perhaps Mr. Fager, I beg your pardon, Jim Shepke, if you'd like to come forward, and Dave Fager, if we could, and let's go ahead. Katie, we were down and had approved basically the current service level, we were in the option packages. If you would like to take us there,
right? Actually, we've gone through the option packages under the current service level. The package 102 with the package set for the TBAB staff volunteer program, for the volunteer program. And then package 103, package 102 requires a 0.75 FTE, and they were actually had that position in package 103, and they're shifting it to package 102. And then package 105 was the purchase of the system furniture for $93,000, which is a proposal. And then the governor's recommended budget was $11,160,756. Then we were down to the adjustment, and the Attorney General hourly rate reduction was this is going from $92 to $90, and it was a minus 58 of other funds. And then my recommendation was to approve package 102, but shift it to other funds. Chair, you had asked me to sit down with the Department of Administrative Service budget analyst and also the library and discuss if this was appropriate and that if they had adequate funds in the other fund revenue, and we have determined that yes, they do have adequate funding or revenues in their other fund expenditure. And so I would continue to recommend that we shift that $45,030 from general fund to other funds.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? And then, I beg your pardon, in the package 105, we talked about the reduction and the furniture and fixture package of the $21,695 on 105 before.
Right, and it will be unscheduled. I'm recommending that it
okay,
be unscheduled.
Unscheduled.
Yeah, the balance, 71305.
Are there any questions of the members to Ms. Cannon?
Okay, they make sure that the package 102, they can use the other funds.
Correct. There are three sources of other funds. One is the assessment, which is not appropriate for this particular package, the assessment for all the other agencies. Then there are two other sources. Three. There's donations, interest income from the donations, and miscellaneous receipts. And where we really looked at was the miscellaneous receipts, and there is adequate revenue there to cover this particular package.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Fager, or Mr. Shipke, would you like to comment on the recommended budget at this particular point?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate your consideration and the opportunity to work with Ms. Cannon, and we do concur with her recommendations at this time.
Thank you very kindly. We did have one item of budget narrative. We've had Ms. Cannon do some rather exhaustive research, and I know that she has visited with yourself, Mr. Shipke, and one of the unique opportunities that we have as Oregonians is that per capita, our state is probably the leader in the United States of technology, and at this particular point, I would like to have Ms. Cannon just go ahead and discuss with us a brief narrative that we're posing that would go on to the budget narrative itself.
The question that the chair had posed to me was wondering if right now they're using tapes, I think it's four-track tapes for the talking book program, and how soon would they be moving to CD-ROM or some other format like that. So I went into the internet to the Library of Congress and looked at what they were doing, and actually they had a full packet and they had a full plan to be moving to some digital format in the next 5 to 10 years. And in talking to Mr. Shepke, he indicated that just 2 weeks ago, he talked to them, they were out here, talking about, you know, some of the things that they were looking into and that they are making progress in an area. In fact, we expect them to be moving to some format like that within 5 years is what their goal is at this point. So I think that your interest had to deal with, you know, reporting back to the various legislative assemblies until that, you know, change takes place and what impact it would have on this particular budget and what, you know, part the Congress would continue to pay for.
It's my understanding that Congress is basically taking the lead with regard to the financial portion of it, but recognizing Oregon's high level of access to technological innovation, we would like to offer through the and have the administration staff of the Oregon State Library offer Oregon to become a federal grant applicant for a pilot conversion project so that we could perhaps lead the nation in the overall conversion, pursuing grants and other funds for a pilot project, moving not just the digitized talking book portion, but other technological innovations that are available to us, and we feel like that this is a great opportunity for Oregon to maybe receive additional grant funds that could be very much enhanced, and I think that there are probably other rather substantial donors that could be our benefactors in moving forward. And we would encourage, and basically the narrative would encourage that a report be brought to the 71st Legislative Assembly and each assembly thereafter to show where Oregon is at in the application process. And it wouldn't hurt my feelings at all to have Oregon within 2 years be the only state in the nation that is all digitized, moved faster than any other state towards this program, and basically blaze the trail and show others the path because of the great learning institutions that this state has and the great opportunities and the great leadership, quite frankly, that we have to the Oregon State Library, and we commend for it. Do you feel that that's something that you could comfortably pursue just in your spare time?
Mr. Chair, we are very excited about moving forward digitized talking books, and the real benefit of that, besides some cost savings, we believe over time, would be that many, many more books would be available to the blind patrons of our library. Right now, every book that we have has to be recorded, which is a very labor-intensive, costly process. What we see in the future is that the Library of Congress will have every book in a digital form, and with improvements in synthesized speech technology, it'll be the case that every book will be available to our patrons instead of really a very small percentage. So that's very, very exciting, and I appreciate the chair's interest in that, and we would be happy to bring a report back.
Senator Trill, I know that this is a labor of love on your behalf, so would you like to make comments or anything for the record at this point? So
I think this is really a very good idea. I'm glad to see us moving forward with this. It's exciting to think that all the materials would be available, not
yes.
just those that
not just for the sight and hearing,
right.
There are those of us who are otherwise impaired that would like to listen to books as we drive along too. But I feel like this is a great opportunity for us, and we would just encourage that and perhaps recognizing the commitment of the chief executive of the state, Governor Kitzhaber, and his desire to move forward with the education process. I think this will enhance the education process at all levels of government. So if we feel comfortable in making that narrative, that's not in the form of a budget note, it's in the form of narrative to encourage that. I think that perhaps in that process, that narrative could be worded in such a fashion that Governor Kitzhaber could come down to the State Library and make a ceremonial signing of an actual request of the National Library, the Library of Congress, so that they know that we're absolutely serious and that we can move forward with that project. Other comments or questions relative to this? Senator Curley?
Just a related item, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for recognition. There is a committee in your chamber that's intent on dismantling some tax credits and some opportunities to stimulate donations of new high technology equipment from kindergarten through college, which was passed in the last legislative session. I hope they're unsuccessful in that effort, since that was my bill from the last legislative session. But rather than dismantling those credits, we ought to take that bill, which has a good relating clause, and add the library as a place where donations of high technology equipment would reasonably earn a tax credit for high technology companies, and maybe we could leverage some of the equipment needed to do the digitalization from these Oregon manufacturers of memory and hardware and programming, and that would make, the Lord helps those that help themselves, and this would be one more incentive that would help bring that high technology to bear on the talking books.
Recognizing that bill is out there, Senator Ferrioli, and the concerns where it would dismantle a portion of the good work that you've done, will you help us intercept that and put me in touch with the correct people so that I can put in a good word? Because
pleasure.
That could be our local match.
It's a pleasure to follow your lead in that activity.
Thank you very much. That could certainly participate as our local match of any of those kinds of funds. It would give a tax credit for those companies that provided that match. It would leave them with the lead technology inside of the State Library as we convert to the Library of Congress. So I appreciate that comment. We'll pursue that. And as I say, if that budget narrative could be in such a fashion that it could receive the endorsement and signature at the State Library of the Chief Oracle of this state, our executive leader, then we could move forward in such a fashion that it would really lend weight and authority to what's happening here. With that, the legislative recommended budget, Katie?
The recommended budget is $11,139,003 for the school binding loan, total fund.
Okay.
Sure. Let's see, we better get to reviewing your votes.
I'm not sure if one of them will drink the coffee and the other will own the restroom, so there we go.
I wasn't sure.
That's fine. Senator Crowe's recognized.
Mr. Crowe, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ferriola.
Mr. Ferriola.
Whoever.
I did that to him last
person. I feel like those around the hall.
I don't have any brains, but otherwise I'm okay. I'm going to move this so that we accept the LFO recommendation. I did want to ask a question, though, related to what I thought was a very nice suggestion made earlier, that the bill that would increase the ready-to-read donation to public libraries would accompany this budget. I don't know whether it can or not, but is it going to get here sometime?
It will get here. It's in the Senate, and I don't know whether or not it's been voted upon. I'm trying to remember whose name. My name is on the bill, but I'm trying to. But that bill is out there, and it's it represents.
You know where it is, Mr.
I believe it did pass the Senate Education Committee.
Okay, so
with a referral to Ways and Means.
With a referral to Ways and Means.
That's right.
So, when it gets to Ways and Means, can we get
in possession of it. Can we attempt to get possession of that bill and bring it here? It might be logical for it to be run to the education, but if we can intercept it, or request it, I guess is a better word, if we could request it for here from the chairs, the co-chairs, that would be the appropriate disposition of that bill. Thank you. The motion has been made by Senator Trowe that we approve the legislative fiscal recommendations being general fund of $2,748,888, other funds of $4,835,780, federal funds of $3,554,335, with a total budget of $11,139,003, 45 positions at 44.38 full-time equivalency positions. Are there any objections to moving that with due pass to the full joint ways and means committee? There being none, so ordered, we'll move that to the full ways and means. Senator Scholl, would you feel comfortable chairing that to the full ways and means? All right, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Sheffield. Thank you, Mr. Sheffield. Could you carry that to the floor? Representing naturally to the floor. And Senator Trowe, would you carry that to the Senate?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you very kindly. And again, thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity. Okay. We'll now open back up our work session on the public session on Senate Bill 5541, Department of Revenue. And I can only carry 200 pounds at a time in addition to that, which lost over my bed. And I've left my copy of your budget. I beg your pardon.
That's happened before, Representative Messer.
Having meetings at meetings. I will be coming to see my system.
We were wrapping up the property and the question was, could we move right into the policy packages? The rest of the information is information which is more detailed than some of the summary information that we've looked at relative to the cost and the revenues and the number of fee payers dealing with each of the various kinds of programs that are administered by the Department of Revenue. So if we could move then into the packages, that would be as you wish, Ms. Archenko. We proceed in the fashion that you would like to at this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. Elizabeth Archenko, Director of the Department of Revenue. With me today, my Deputy Jim Brown and Administrator of our Personal Tax and Compliance Division, Susan Brown. What we'd like to do today is to go through with you the policy package that was recommended in the governor's original recommended budget and the package that was included in the rebalance budget. Page 53 in our binder addresses the first of those packages. And as we talk to you, as Susan and I talk to you about the, and John Todd about the income tax programs, we referred periodically through that presentation to the kinds of things that we would like to do with the resources that we've requested in a, what we call the tax compliance policy package. It's actually got four different numbers on it because parts of that package affect four different parts of the agency. So the package numbers are 320, 330, 350, and 360, I believe. Collectively, the package would provide staff to assist taxpayers in filing and paying taxes voluntarily and correctly, and to bring more non-filers into the system, into compliance, through a combination of education and enforcement. And the package would also provide more automation resources to the department to allow us to continue to improve our major systems and provide increasing taxpayer assistance. And the specific aspects of the package from a programmatic point of view, in the personal income tax program, we want to increase the amount of outreach we're able to do through our field offices. We'd like to be able to provide some taxpayer assistance during the filing season. Currently, we are not able to do that. We'd like to be able to do more outreach into the community by providing training seminars and classes for individuals and business taxpayers. And we told you in the last couple of days that we do as much of that as we can now with current staff, going out especially to programs that are attended by new people who are newly going into business or who are newly employing people for the first time, so that they can be on track and understanding what the law requires them to do and how they can do it and where they can go for assistance if they're confused or having trouble. We'd like to, I have heard, as I've visited the field offices, I have heard from my staff that it is very, very important for them to have a presence in the community, not only in which the office is located, but that the office has responsibility for. And by providing outreach assistance, getting outside the office and out into the community will also help with getting taxpayers into compliance. We would also be doing some additional work to identify other people who are not currently filing and should be, and work to bring them into compliance for the long term. Our goal with people who are not filing right now is not to just bill them and collect taxes from them and then walk away from them. It's really to get them back into the system and filing timely and paying as they are supposed to over the long term. And we would also, out in the field, conduct audits focused on specific areas where our experience is that noncompliance is high. And we would put administrative specialists and a tax auditor and revenue agent to work doing that work. We've also recognized that people who are self-employed and aren't in the withholding system are at a little bit higher risk for noncompliance or errors, and so we would put another group of people to work on focusing on the self-employed, identifying folks who are not filing and paying voluntarily and working with them to get them in compliance, developing accurate assessments for those who won't comply, contacting and working with self-employed taxpayers so that they understand what their obligations are and to resolve liabilities, and provide field contacts. Right now we have a lot of folks in the Salem office who do telephone contacts with people who have tax debts, and we'd like to be able to provide a few more people out in the field to make personal contact with folks where the telephone isn't the best way to work. Also to do more education for self-employed, and we would use again, tax auditors, revenue agents, and administrative specialists to do that work. We also are asking for some revenue agents to work with the expected 2,000 to 3,000 new non-filing taxpayers that would be identified through the department's new automated filing enforcement program.
Could you give us some sense of how the automated system would work to identify 2,000 taxpayers have been out of the system for some time?
The new automated filing enforcement program is just coming up, and basically it does a lot more matching of the data that we have with the information from the IRS and from other sources, so it's a lot more automated. data matching to identify those who appear to have a likelihood of being non-filers. So we'll do a lot more of that work for us on an automated basis versus what it is currently. So we do expect to identify some new non-filing taxpayers that we haven't been aware of, and we think it's real important to be able to follow up with those individuals.
Excuse me, Senator Scurrielli.
Mr. Chairman, is there any thought to having an amnesty period for to bring folks online without having to face potential back filings and the incentive to become and remain a non-filing taxpayer grows as the potential for penalty and prosecution increase? And I wondered if there was an amnesty period to bring people who are discovered in this process online as taxpayers.
Go ahead and respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I'm Jim Brown, Deputy Director of the Department. When Governor Neil Goldsmith was first elected, there were a number of states that were involved in tax amnesty programs at that time, and he was very interested in the potential of a tax amnesty and the potential of collecting some of the revenue that should be coming into the state that wasn't at that time. He had us actually send some staff back to Massachusetts, who they were in the middle of a fairly successful amnesty program. And the result of that, there was some legislation proposed. Senator Handy at the time was a very strong advocate for tax amnesty. And there was a very significant amount of debate in the revenue committees. Ultimately, they decided not to do an amnesty. They did add some resource at that time to do some additional enforcement. But the logic, as I understood it at the time, was that most states that got significant amount of money from the tax amnesty not only applied a tax amnesty to not only people that were not in the system, not non-filers or people that hadn't reported all their income, but they also applied it to their current delinquent accounts receivable, known delinquent accounts. And they said if you had filed a return 2 years ago and only paid half the tax that you had owing, we will waive some of the penalty and interest. And the ones that were successful in raising significant amount of revenue did both. And there was a lot of concern on the part of the legislature and the revenue committees as they debated that possibility that you know, people that really were known and were in the system and didn't pay would get some sort of an advantage over people and treatment better maybe than people that had paid. And so at that time, there was a decision not to go with an amnesty. But it was looked at very thoroughly. It was debated very thoroughly. And we have thought about it on occasion since then. But it's really fascinating to me in watching this, too, over the years. When this first occurred in the mid to late 80s and it became more of a national phenomenon, a number of states advertised one time, tax amnesty, come on in now and get you in the system. And then 5 years later, they were doing it again. And part of the concern was, and the committee was just that, you know, once the amnesty period is over, and if you're not in the system at that point, then is your incentive to not get in the system and hope that in 5 years there'll be another amnesty period, so might there be a negative impact on compliance over a long time. But those are a lot of the factors that went into the discussion at the time and a lot of the debate. But it's a fascinating concept.
I have one question with regard to the amnesty process. If we were to do any further research on amnesty, is there any indication that the rather substantial amounts of outstanding liabilities that we have right now could be collected in a more rapid fashion through one of the described amnesty programs that you have also would offer amnesty for outstanding balances as well? Would that be contemplated? Or looks like we're collecting on back taxes large amounts sufficiently to not offer that. You wouldn't ever consider that as part of an amnesty program.
My personal opinion would be that an amnesty program should not cover accounts receivable that you're already aware of, that you're already working with the taxpayers.
In the system.
That are already in the system. The the distinction I was trying to draw for you is those states that did that, that only applied it to those that were unknown to the system, typically didn't collect great amounts of money from their amnesty programs. They typically got fairly small amounts. In Oregon, for example, we don't prosecute for tax evasion. The state of Oregon doesn't have any positions. We don't do any criminal prosecutions. If we become aware that that's a problem, we turn information over to the IRS and they prosecute. The reason for that is about 10 years ago when I met with IRS, they were spending an average of $200,000 to $250,000 a prosecution, one taxpayer. And that gets to some of the comments Senator Lynn was making yesterday. We've made the judgment that if we spend $250,000 and we can work with 200 taxpayers, we're better off than doing that. But the fact that we don't criminally prosecute, that means there's one less thing we can say we can offer up in an amnesty. We can't say if you come forward we won't prosecute because
right.
We don't prosecute anymore.
I have a question to Ms. Brown with regard to the discovery of the 2,000 non-filers. How can there be 2,000 non-state filers out there that are already in the Internal Revenue Service records that we shouldn't be aware of, where we're already actively sharing information on a day-to-day basis?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. The new filing system we're working on, the filing enforcement program, takes information not only from the IRS but from some other sources as well. So we would merge a lot of different sources of data to try and determine, do some matching where there's some income and we don't show it. You're right, it should appear at the IRS. It's the Internal Revenue Service. It should be appearing. We should get it through our current mechanisms. But there are sources of doing data matches that we can find leads on income that we don't have currently.
Leads on income that we don't have currently as well. I'm just a little bit, that leaves me a little bit cold. I guess from what I saw, it was a very efficient run operation with lots of information sources. Please help me with that.
Mr. Chair, one example would be one that you've discussed earlier. If we have information from a contractor's board, for example, and if that information contains a Social Security number, our assumption is going to be if you're registered as a contractor in Oregon, you're probably making enough income that you ought to at least be filing tax returns. Now, of the 2,000 to 3,000 that Susan talks about, there are most of those probably are not in the federal system either. Most of the non-filers we find are not filing either state or federal returns.
And that's the difficulty is that the IRS, or the Internal Revenue Service, would not be able to provide us a great deal of information about either the individual nor any of the financial affairs. And I guess my concern would be also those offline cash businesses that may be very legitimate businesses, selling pencils on the street corner or whatever, that would be very legitimate businesses, but not in the system. And so tell me about the offline sources. Would that be from some sort of a 1099 program, a rent program, an information return program, from the construction industry, from the barbers and beauticians and therapeutic, those other folks? Now, I understand that we can't presently request Social Security information from the numbers as we ask them to fill out an application for a license. Is that right?
For most boards, that's correct, Mr. Chair. They can request it, but they can't demand it. And they can, if they request it under federal law, I'm not an attorney, I believe they have to make it clear that it's a request and the person does not have to provide the information.
Would perhaps one of the ways that we can, some of the other Ways and Means Committee, we've approved rather substantial packages for information control. As a matter of fact, one of the packages that we approved, I believe it was in one of the medical licensing books that dealt with just the filters that they wanted to put in on to find out everyone that had any kind of action taken against them, against their particular license. And the package that I think that she showed us, that the director showed us, got 3 inches thick of paper, but all she was after was just, you know, about every 3 pages there was someone in there that had a violation against her license. So with that filtering equipment that they're putting on to the 17, 18 health board licenses and other board licenses and the other boards that the state administers, whether it's the Board of Licensed Tax Consultants, the Board of Tax Examiners, whichever of the boards, could we filter for Social Security numbers where they have requests or where that number has been left blank and do some cross matching on that?
If I understand your comment correctly, yes. We also do we do matching with board licenses where there is not a Social Security number. The problem with that is it creates a lot more exceptions that have to be looked at manually.
Right.
But if I were if I had a landscape architecture license and I had that, my office in my home, and you had the board have my name and my address and not my Social Security number, we can still match up against our system to my name and address, and we can say, yes, there's a return for Jim Brown and the system. If I had an office with a different address, then if they matched up, they might say, well, we don't see a perfect match, but here's a possibility, and we check it out and see if that was the return, but it takes a little more manual work.
Well, Jim, let me just kind of cut to the chase if I can, and let me just say this. I'm wondering if the tools are already available to us so that we could determine fairly early on without a great deal of expenditure to determine how close to the bell curve we are of the law of diminishing returns. I guess that I do not have a comfort level relative to this particular tax package that for each dollar expended that we're going to get the amount of expected and anticipated revenue back. And I think for very little investment to do just some of the kinds of cross-matching that we're seeing, that we're talking about, and then the merging of that information from the boards that we already control, that you may be able to, for a few thousands of dollars, be able to get a pretty decent list and you know, I mean, if you've got amongst the health board licenses, therapeutic technicians and x-ray technicians and massage technicians and the various other kinds of lists, that the names show up, the addresses show up, and there's no such person as filing a federal return nor an Oregon return, then you've got a pretty good indication that you might have a live one there. And I think that could be obtained without a great deal of FTE equivalency here. So Senator Troll has recognized that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I remember in other sessions when we've really invested in additional auditors for tax compliance, we've been able to generate substantially additional money, and that those positions have more than paid their way in terms of additional revenue. My guess is that the $8 million that's anticipated from this package is in the governor's budget.
Yeah, it's spent, yeah.
So we need that money, and yeah. So I think we need these positions. I don't know that you can find the same amount of money by just making some minor adjustments.
I think, Senator, what my primary concern is that how close to the bell curve are we for the law of diminishing returns? Because if we're working halfway up the bell curve, you know, an expenditure of $1 million can generate $8 million. Could an expenditure of $2 million generate $13 million? And what I'd like to know is how early on we can determine how close up the bell curve we are, or if we're over the top.
Well, I guess I don't know about the bell curve, and maybe you guys do, so maybe you can come back and tell us why it was you believe that with these additional positions we could get better tax compliance and we could make this amount of money. And if that's the bell curve and you need to show us one, please do. But I know it's your best estimate, and I know the history will back this up, that when we've done this, we have made more money because we get more compliance.
Yeah.
Chair, I'm going to show a couple of points. Mr. Chair, you're correct that there can be some automation, and we are automating up to the point of identifying the non-filer. A lot of the work in this package comes from that point forward when we know Jim Brown, landscape architect, hasn't filed. And we start sending letters. A lot of times that person still won't file. And then we have to do some work to try and say, okay, how can we estimate what their income is? Are there some records that we can get? Are there some, are there any other indicators that would give us an idea of how much income they've made? For a lot of these people, they will not file, and we have to assess tax based on our best information. And so we have to generate information to do that. Then it often becomes a collection problem, and that's why there are revenue agents in the package, because the person now not only has refused to file, they won't pay. We talk a lot about some of the people in situations in their lives that choose not to file, and if they have a problem, once we talk to them, usually they'll come forward. But there's the other side. We had in one of the earlier packages that Senator Scho talks about, we found a self-employed individual in Portland, and for confidential reasons, I can't give you much more information. This gentleman had a business. His business generated in addition to $5 million a year in receipts. He hadn't filed returns for 7 years with the state of the IRS. He probably put several hundred hours into working his account, getting the information, finally getting returns, and then a lot of work in finally getting all the money he owes. But that the identification is really fairly automated today, and about as much as we can given our ability to get
this. And I guess I misunderstood. The expense that you're talking about here for the 41 positions is really the auditor positions, those folks who, for the rubber hits the road. It's not the identification process.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. As Susan explained, we've got a new system that's just coming online that's going to help us identify people faster. And then what we need are the auditors and the revenue agents to go out and work with those people so that the assessment is set up or their returns get filed and the money comes in. So it's that work that needs to be done after the identification takes place. It would be wonderful if we could just identify people and send them a letter and they'd say, oh, sorry, here's 7 years of returns and a check. It just doesn't happen that way. So it's that work that needs to be done by people as we locate folks.
Let me ask one additional piece of information I'll get off of this, because this is an important package. And I just don't want to walk past any, you know, as Senator Crow says, it yields us money, always has in the past, and we would hope that it always would in the future, but at some point, everybody's just going to be honest and go kind of utopian society.
I hope so.
you have also access to the real estate records in all 36 counties, and you have access to a printout or the automated information there. And I guess this fictitious Jim Brown that we just talked about just a moment ago, another Jim Brown, he could be registered as a licensed massage therapist and have a business license and have all of these other things, none of which are show up either through the Internal Revenue Service or tax returns filed at the state level, but you do have the ability to reach in and take a look to see if there's any Jim-bound real estate at that particular address. Is that correct? As well, right now through the existing resources.
We do, but it's not going to be as fast as it will be with the automated system.
Right, but with the automated system that we talked about, then all of this kind of melds and blends together. Now, these people normally would not have bank accounts because that does require a Social Security number.
Mr. Chair, the sources of information are only limited probably by your imagination, and it really is the resource to make the contact and get the data in some sort of a form that we can then use in our system. But one of the challenges for data exchange that we've been able to work out with the Internal Revenue Service, because it's in both of our best interests, is format of electronic information. And so as we talk to other state agencies about helping us with databases, that's going to be a part of the work is us saying, can you give it to us in this format, and then saying yes or no, and if the answer is no, then trying to work out a way to get the information. Then whether they have asked for Social Security.
Okay, I'm going to ask this question twice today, but how closely are you working with the Department of Administrative Services Information Management Resource Bureau? IRM, the Information Resource Management Division, sorry.
With Information Resources Management to get this kind of data?
Yes, to extract data from the, in other words, they have the technical expertise to provide you that and they're the people to whom we are looking and the other agencies to provide you that, to provide them the technical resources to do these things. Are you working closely with the IRMD?
Mr. Chair, the Information Resources Management Division has a long-term strategy, which I know they shared with you, with the committee, mm-hmm. on integrating data from the local level, the state level, so there's a lot more access to it, and we will certainly participate in the planning of that so that we can take advantage of the availability of the data. It's something that we are looking forward to with great anticipation, and if we can get some of the information systems positions that we've asked for in the budget, we can get there faster.
Okay.
That's really one of the issues, is that in order to take advantage of technology, you need the people who understand how to work it.
I'll attempt to work a little closer with you to make sure that with regard to the we're high enough on the bell curve that we're not walking away from money.
Well, I just wanted to address your bell curve question just one last time. We gave you this chart that's on page 36, and as Jim told you, this represents close to $700 million of taxes. So if we're talking about an investment of 4 to get 8, that's about 1% of this. So we don't think that we're close to the top of the bell curve. And as the population of the state continues to grow, that the absolute numbers of people who are in that slice of the pie is going to continue to grow.
I guess I would have expected it. But you do have more technical information than just looking at the 8.8% and saying.
Oh yes.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
We have that. Yeah. We have the historic information
okay.
over time of every time we make a change and you give us more people, what we've been able to what we committed to and been able to produce.
Thank you. I was hoping. thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Mr. Chair, when we talk about this policy package in our agency, we don't talk about it as a goal. We talk about it as a commitment.
Okay.
And we have, as Senator Crowley said, we've been asked to do this on a number of other occasions. We've always viewed it as a commitment. We have always made the goal or exceeded it. And if you approve the package, I can personally guarantee you we will make or exceed this goal. Or I will be toast.
We all will be toast.
Thank you very much, Jim. We appreciate that. I think we should. Other comments relative to that tax compliance policy tax, that particular one?
Well, just wanted to tell you some of the other things that would be included in that package. In our withholding program, which John Scott spoke to you about the other day, we would add revenue agents and office specialists to provide more support to employers so that they can report and accurately pay withholding and payroll taxes that they're obligated to pay, get out into the community again. John told you about the pilot program, or the new program that was started about 15 months ago, where we had two agents that just started to visit construction sites in Portland and had the ability to bring about 150 businesses into voluntary compliance. And this is front-end work, as I call it, that enables people to comply now so that they don't incur penalties. They're doing it right from the very beginning, and we'd like to expand that. We also have in our proposal additional
Now, this is where my budget ignorance comes up. I'm never sure whether it's capital outlay or services and supplies. I just know it's not people. Additional money for two year-round toll-free lines for taxpayer assistance. Currently, we have five seasonal toll-free lines, but we have people who have questions all year round, and we'd like to, from outside the Salem area, and we'd like to be able to provide them toll-free access to the department's tax help staff. We also talked to you during the tour about our voice response system, and we'd like to upgrade that system so that we can give taxpayers greater access to their account data and a little bit better access to auditors and revenue agents who can answer the more complex questions that our tax help staff is not able to address. I just mentioned a moment ago that there's a fairly substantial number of additional information system staff in this package. When Jim went through our innovations from the past and then talked to you about the planned innovations over the next 4 years, it's the staff that's in this package that we would expect to assign to that work. And it would be to oversee additional major project development and modifications, develop and redesign how our systems work together. Right now we have a mainframe computer, and we also have a local area network of personal computers. And what's happening in the technology is that the what they call the platform for the personal computers and the mainframe computer are becoming more and more alike and better able to integrate. And we some of the staff that we've asked for would be continuing to improve the connection points between those two platforms. And specifically, we have about 2 years of deferred maintenance due to staffing shortages in our current really big systems, like our integrated tax collections account and our personal income tax return processing system. We would put those people to work to catch up on that deferred maintenance. We also, we've been very, very lucky in one area of our computer services that we've been able to retain staff, but we haven't been so lucky in some other areas, and so we need to be able to continue to recruit and bring people on and train them and cover for the fact that that turnover is there just due to the market for people in our information systems specialists. We need to rewrite some of our older programs that are getting to be 8 to 10 years old. They're in an older language. They aren't as flexible, and be a major project for us to rewrite so that they can meet the demands that our staff have for being able to work more efficiently. And to continue to develop both intranet and intranet within the agency platforms and tools to meet both our own employees' demands so that they can do their work more effectively and taxpayers' expectations. So that's pretty much the big pieces of that policy package that was included in the governor's recommendation.
That covered four different divisions, as I recall. I think Representative Messerly had a question relative to part of the GIS and the and some of the capabilities of it. Representative Messerly is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're going through this over the last couple of days. I apologize for not being present very often, but we've been through several budgets and natural resources as well as here in which GIS programs have come up. And my question is that wouldn't it be possible to combine staffing on some of these programs and localize it? One of the comments we've heard is that they have to prepare the information so that they can go on a system. But it seems to me that with so much GIS work going, and particularly with your mapping program, that this would help to be some efficiencies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, there is a piece of legislation, House Bill 2139, a number many of you are becoming very familiar with, that provides some funding for the continuation of support to the assessment and taxation system. There is a little tiny bit of money that's earmarked in that for the geographic information system development. And our goal, if that passes, is to partner with the Information Resources Management Division with their geographic information services section and our cartography section and find ways to start to really move us into the digital age with the mapping. For those of you who went on the tour, you saw that our staff already has, in addition to the tax map in the digital database, the ability to do about 63 different overlays, rivers and roads and utilities and everything else already in some of the databases for some of the counties that we're working with. And so when that dollar comes through, that little bit of money comes through, then that would be the first thing. In fact, I've already got somebody that I'm looking at as a project manager to work with information resources management to find a way to make that become reality.
Along those lines, in my district as well as other areas throughout Oregon, especially on the coast, we've been dealing a lot with fiber optics. And particularly with it in the south coast with the AT&T line coming in from China and between Peace Bay and Bandon. In my learning curve, which is vertical throughout this process, they've got, I'm going to cost me some money here, but because I don't know what they stand for, but they call the access points. So avoid this.
Points of presence.
Well, that point of transit, and then there's another one that's it's called NAPS, but I don't know what it stands for. Network Access Point, I believe it is. But with those,
well, that's not what I call a NAP.
In those discussions, what we found is that there's no inventory by anyone in the state, evidently, as to where those access points are. And further, in discussions with the Division of State Lands, they are not able to find out where in the state of Oregon the fiber optic lines are laid. And so after having that conversation, then it took me a while to think this through, how are we taxing these facilities if no one in the state has an inventory, and how are you dealing with that, if no one in the state has an inventory where these facilities are?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, if the fiber optic lines are owned by telecommunications companies, which I'm assuming that they are, they have to report to us all of their property. And where it's, where, whether it's, at least whether it's inside or outside the state and what county it's in. And we have quite a process of returns that the companies file with us to tell us what their investment in property is, including laying a new cable that comes into us on an annual basis and that we take into account in determining the value of the company's property. So we might not know exactly where in terms of whether it's along one highway or another highway or under a roadbed or crossing underneath a railroad track, but they do have to report to us the investment that they've made in that kind of property, and it becomes a part of the base for taxation of those companies.
Follow-up question. How do you verify that?
Well, at this point, it's more on the honor system than anything else. We have a few people on our appraisal staff who are appraiser auditors. And they do have the training to actually go and audit to make sure that the report is accurate. But at this point, the resource has to be devoted to just getting the property tax rolled out every year. And so there's not a lot of that auditing that takes place. Most of the centrally assessed companies all are publicly traded. They all have to report to the federal government. And so we rely on the accuracy of their reports.
Certainly follow. Okay. Is that proprietary information, or is that information
The information that's filed with the federal government, or?
Or even your records.
Well, if we get records that are from a public source, then in our possession they would be public. If we get them directly from the taxpayer and the taxpayer does identify them as proprietary, or if they're on a property tax return that the statutes protect as being confidential, then it's confidential in our hands. But we get information from both sources.
Follow-up question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In conversation with Don Maziotti from DAS, the information I've received is that the only basic information that he and that department can receive is when they go out to bid for a service, and they can tell from the type of bids they get back what kind of capabilities the different companies have. Seems to me a very archaic way for the
state of Oregon to really know what we have here and where it's at and what potential capabilities it might have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I think that what I've observed in my years in state service, and I think other people would agree, is that we have a lot of separate repositories of information in state government. And because of the lack of automation technology in the past, it's been submitted on paper and kept on paper. And sharing it is very difficult. And as we move now into an age where we have the ability to communicate and have data come to us initially in an electronic form, our ability to share it between the Information Resources Management Division, the Revenue Department, the Division of State Lands, the Forestry Department is going to become so much easier just because it's coming in a format that everybody can use rather than not even knowing what somebody might have because it's in paper in a file cabinet. So we're going to see just tremendous changes in the future, and I think the Geographic Information System is one resource that's going to allow that to happen. We have had, as we've talked about, trying to do a statewide digital mapping project, a lot of interest expressed by utility companies that having that information available to them would allow them to do some really effective planning, and we could then work on data exchange. It'd be helpful for everyone.
I guess that left one question in my mind, and that was just DAS may acquire some of the information by looking at bid sheets, but you should have it already in the form of personal property tax returns. Now, do you try and graph on your personal property tax returns the information that's given to you relative to the utility, central assessed utility lines and those kinds of things? Do you try to graph that information onto the GIS mapping system at all?
Mr. Chair, I think that the format in which we get the information is still, number one, it's still on paper, and it's aggregate. It's aggregate investment and plant. So we get a big number of how much was invested. I think what I'd like to do is maybe pursue with you and Representative Messerly independently with one of my real experts exactly how much information we get in the course of working in the property tax system that would allow for location identification.
I think that's what Senator Messerly is looking for, and I think you, because of the leverage that you have, and I recognize, and we're not trying to breach the confidentiality of the forms that we're talking about, but I think they have an obligation, as I read the personal property tax return, they have an obligation to identify exactly where every bit of that property is, because it crosses school boundary lines and fire district lines and all of those kinds of things. And so when they report to you that they have 300 miles of fiber in the state of Oregon or 3,000 miles of telephone cable in the state of Oregon, you can't stop at that particular, they can't stop reporting at that particular point. They must report to you exactly where it's all at, and I think that's where Representative Messerly is asking if we could go, and really you have, I guess, Director Archangel, you have the keys, because under the violation of the laws of perjury, they have to give you some very specific information. Now, I'd want to make absolutely certain that we didn't cross over, and we would probably want legislative counsel or some counsel to make sure that we did not cross over any of the boundaries. But the return itself is filed under the laws of penalties of perjury, but they must identify exactly the location of all property identified on that return.
Mr. Chair, your level of expertise sounds like it's higher than mine on the personal property tax return. So what I'd like to do is just get one of my staff who really deals with those things and sit down with you and talk about it. But at least in terms of the relationship between the department and the Information Resources Management Division and other state agencies that have information that's of value, it seems that the Geographical Information System and getting all that information into a digital format and related back to a single set of maps has incredible potential, and we're committed to work toward that.
I think you're on to something there. I really do. Thank you very much. Other questions relative to the tax compliance policy package? A further explanation at this point?
Sure, I just think it's a good deal for the city.
I think it's Senator Crow the benefits, and I've visited with Representative Messerly on this particular issue a number of times. I know the level of frustration that they've gone through trying to identify where this rather substantial infrastructure is at, and of course I recognize that we're not going to try and break into any I guess we could call them trade secrets, but what we're after is to know what the infrastructure actually looks like when we put it on to the GIS grid. And
I think it's, you know, just for those of us who pay our taxes conscientiously, and it's a very important act of citizenship that we do when we do that. It makes sense that other people also pay their taxes, mm-hmm. and we'd be interested to see if they do that.
Thank you, Senator Carroll.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one final comment on that policy package, I think it's important that you know that the way the benefit of the package is calculated is we will track the direct dollars from the people we work with, and the system will, in reality, benefit by much more than that $8 million. For example, if the gentleman I mentioned that had $5 million in sales, didn't file for 7 years, our data would include the money we got from him in the biennium toward our commitment.
But keep my family out of this.
But that gentleman has continued to file and pay since then. None of those dollars are counted toward this $8 million, but the state has benefited every year for about the last 4 or 5 years since that point. So people that we bring into the system, a high percentage of them, once they have been identified, get in the system and stay in the system. And we're only counting in our revenue projections the money that comes in from that direct action, not by the follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a much greater long-term benefit to the system, which in reality is more important than the immediate dollars.
And I hope you don't feel that I don't have confidence in what you're doing, but the final paragraph of that uses the words anticipate increased future voluntary compliance, estimating difficult, those kinds of words in that last paragraph on page 53 left me with more than just a little less than warm feeling, more than just a question or two that I would like to, I'd like, and the dollars that we're talking about are all very specific dollars. When we're saying an investment of $4,155,901 will generate $8,063,280, there's obviously more than just grabbing for numbers in the dark. So I wanted to have a better feeling for that.
This actually represents two different things. The bottom paragraph really is in response to the question is what would be that long-term effect on voluntary compliance of these activities? That's more difficult to estimate than the direct dollars. The $8 million is a calculation based on what our staff produces, and we keep very detailed records on, and we know on average what a revenue agent will produce working a certain kind of work.
But
that is not a goal, it's a commitment.
That certainly answers the questions that I had relative to that tax package, and I would like to perhaps get together and share additional information, and then as we've indicated, I know that Representative Messerly, as does Senator Ferrioli, have a high level of interest in determining through some of the GIS activities that you're involved in to try and determine how we can more easily wire the state of Oregon together through this whole process. And as we say, part of this is melding the services that are available within the same building. It would be a terrible shame if there was duplicated efforts on the fifth floor that you're going down on the third floor. So I'm going to go ahead and turn the gavel to Representative Messerly, and he'll continue, and I need to step out for legislative fiscal.
just finishing up on that.
Mr. Chair, are we going to go to a work session on the
We won't be on a work session today.
We'd like to proceed, please.
Okay. What I was going to do now was to go to the other package, which is the in the governor's rebalance. It's not a part of our budget right now, but it was proposed in the governor's rebalance budget. This proposal would add, I believe, 13 positions.
What is that in the...
Well, it's not in the booklet.
Not in the book?
No.
Do you have handouts
for this? In here. In the governor's... Oh, the recommended budget.
It's in the back of the recommended budget?
Oh, it's back on the back of George's document.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's the last page of the report from George Dunford. Thank you very much, Senator Lamb.
Thank you.
The 13 positions for 12 full-time equivalent positions, and the amount of cost was okay. I'm not reading that.
The cost is about $1.2 million. Right. The revision that you see on that page, the 772, is net of the $500,000 general fund reduction in attorney general costs that was also part of the governor's rebalance.
Which, excuse me, Mr. Chair, which package is this? Which number is it? 330, 350, 360?
This is, if you look on the last page, I don't think it's numbered. It's not part of it.
It's not numbered, but it would be broken down between three divisions in the department. The information processing, see, this has all come after the governor's recommended budget was put together. So part of it would go into our information processing division, which would be three positions in an administrative specialist, public service representative who would help out in our tax help area, and an office specialist. The administrative specialist and the office specialist would be supporting the additional, if we have more tax auditors and revenue agents, which would be going into our personal tax and compliance division and our business division, they will generate additional billing and additional correspondence. And so we need more, a little bit more clerical in order to support that additional billings and correspondence. Within the personal tax and compliance division, the position would, the proposal would add five positions, two tax auditor ones, a revenue agent one, a revenue agent three, and a half-time management analyst. Those people would be focusing on self-employed filing enforcement. In the business division, we would add two tax auditor twos working on corporation audits, two revenue agents, one in our payroll unit and one in our accounts resolution unit, both working with businesses on withholding and payroll taxes, and one information system specialist, three. Right now, our business division and our personal tax and compliance division share what they call their systems development unit. And so the computer professionals that support the personal computers that are on everyone's desktop, as well as the shared systems for analyzing information that are on that local area network rather than being on the big computer, are in a unit that is actually shared between those two divisions. And so we would add one more person to that shared unit. Then there's the appropriate capital outlay and services and supplies that go along with the additional position. So it's, as I said, 13 positions, 12 FTEs. The proposal would net $4 million in general fund.
That's pretty much just an expansion of the compliance activity you're already doing, or is it different?
Chair, Senator Trow, it would be an expansion. The self-employed filing enforcement area is one that we have not done a lot of work in. so it would be definitely some growth there, rather than just a uniform expansion of all the activities that we're doing right now.
That's something that will have permanent good effect in terms of what you're doing?
Yes, Senator. If we bring these people on to meet the commitment that is made for this two-year budget cycle, those people continue to produce. And as we do more to support their work with automated systems, they will become more productive along with the rest of the people in the department. So
pretty good move.
Well, we think so, yeah.
Maybe you covered this while I was out. Have you projected what the cost would be to return the kicker?
You mean the actual cost to write the checks? Well, this last time it was $780,000 for right around $1.5 million check.
That comes out of upfront out of the kicker money, so it's not an additional cost in the budget.
Our budget does not contain the other fund limitation to do that. So at this point in the governor's recommended budget, it would be something that we would have to come to the emergency board for authority to spend those other funds if there would be a kicker issue.
Do we have any more
suggestions?
That's all
I
have.
So, Mr. how many in this fund government recommended fund the package? 320, 330, 360, 360. How many of the total positions are we asking?
In the original government's recommended budget, there were 41 positions, 39 and a half full-time equivalents. And in the enhancement package, it's 13 positions, 12 full-time equivalent.
So the original ones, as I read it, how many 54 positions of the current labor, and as I added up, it's 4 policies. It looks like 82.
Senator Lynn, I think the total is 54 positions.
54 positions.
41 from the original governor's recommended, plus 13 from the package in the rebalance.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Thank you very much.